Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.
This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Chartock of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. This week we'll look at organized crime's role in the solid waste industry and what measures can be taken to prevent the violation of environmental conservation laws. We'll hear about the latest state effort to alleviate the overcrowded prisons. And we'll discuss some proposals for cutting down on corruption in the construction industry. The Board of Trustees has agreed to raise the salary of the State University Chancellor, as well as 32 other top officials in the SUNY system. And we'll look at Governor Cuomo's future in politics. That's all coming up on the Legislative Gazette. Maurice Hinchey, you're always tilting with very dangerous windmills. There's the question of the garbage barge and garbage barges and its relationship to what we call enigmatic figures. Is there a mafia connection or a mob connection with our garbage hauling industry and specifically with the barge industry?
Well, there's definitely an organized crime connection in the solid waste industry. As a matter of fact, it's pretty clear that the organized crime people dominate the solid waste industry in downstate New York, in the metropolitan area on Long Island, and in at least the lower Hudson Valley.
So how dangerous is this? In other words, what are the implications for the citizenry if, in fact, the mob gets control of our garbage hauling industry?
Well, there are some obvious environmental dangers. We know, for example, that over the years, a lot of toxic waste has been mixed with ordinary refuse and disposed of in ways in which groundwater contamination can occur and people's health and safety can be put at serious risk. We're seeing the closing of beaches in New Jersey now. Certain contaminants that are appearing in Long Island Sound. Now, there's a good possibility that at least some of that is a result of illegal dumping of waste out in the oceans. And there's a suspicion that some of the dumping, at least the dumping that resulted in the closing of the New Jersey beaches, was from barges illegally done. And it could be that these same or similar people are behind that. So there's a real and serious danger associated with their involvement in this, because they don't, frankly, have to give a damn about anybody's public health and safety. All they're concerned about is the bottom line.
So they don't really, then these are not responsible citizens who are most likely to obey the rules.
Well, that's the point exactly. And the more stringent the rules become, and they're going to become more stringent with regard to solid waste, because they have to, given the dangers associated with handling it improperly, the more likely they are to try to get involved in it and to dominate the industry, which is what they do in major parts of the state right now.
Well, you're a legislator. How are we going to put a stop to this?
Well, first, you know, the main part of it is it's a law enforcement problem. And we know that law enforcement is looking at these people in various ways now. But there are things that we can do here to tighten up on the way in which local government gets involved with these people. We know, for example, with regard to the Islip barge, that the town of Islip did not stick to the general municipal law. They put the project out for bid, but they never awarded it to the responsible bidders that sent in bids. Instead of that, they negotiated a contract with the private sanitation industry in Nassau and Suffolk County, which is dominated by organized crime. Now, they knew that. In fact, the man that they were negotiating with at the time was under multiple indictment from a special grand jury which was impaneled by the New York State Organized Crime Task Force. So there's a lesson there for any municipality in the state, that when you're dealing with solid waste and you involve yourself in a contractual relationship with somebody who comes along and tells you that he can take it off your hands, you have a responsibility to know where he's taking it to and whether or not it's going to be done in the right way. Responsibility to your own citizens and a larger responsibility to the other people of the state.
Now, what about bonding?
Well, that's another requirement that was not adhered to in that particular instance. normally what is required is that whenever someone comes in and takes a contract like that, that there is a bond, and the bond guarantees the contract performance, so that if the contractor is unable, as they were in this particular case, to carry out the provisions of the contract, then the municipality is protected by that bond. There will be some money there which they can use to have the trash taken away by some other, this time hopefully responsible, party. And in the case of the Islip barge, the bonding requirements were not adhered to either. There was no bonding there, so that the community had nothing to fall back upon.
Why did it take Maurice Hinchey, an assemblyman, to blow the whistle on this, as opposed to our governmental apparatus, which is the Department of Environmental Conservation? Why aren't they the ones who are yelling and screaming about this?
Well, we have a responsibility here, and that responsibility is within the context of the Legislative Commission on Solid Waste Management. Now, I happen to be the chairman of that commission. And so when the barge incident occurred, we thought that there might be an illustrative message there. And we wanted to find out exactly how it happened, and when we began to look at it, we discovered all of these facts, the fact that the law wasn't adhered to, and the fact that the town, unfortunately, got itself involved with some shady characters who ended up giving them the short end of the stick.
Now, these are very serious allegations. Do you ever get frayed on any level, either physical or lawsuit-wise, in terms of people coming back at you?
Well, I must admit the thought crosses my mind occasionally, but I think that you really can't allow those things to influence your behavior. You have to look at everything objectively and, based on the facts, act accordingly. That's my job as a member of the legislature, and to find out things, to engage in legislative oversight, to see the way these problems are being handled, and when they're not being handled properly, to let people know about it and to let the other members of the legislature know about it, so that we can collectively make whatever changes are needed in the law to try to ensure that these things don't continue to happen.
Assemblyman Maurice Hinchey. Overcrowded prisons has been a problem for quite a while. But recently, the problem has reached crisis proportions, with local county jails retaining over 2,000 state-ready prisoners waiting to be transferred to state facilities. Corrections Commissioner Thomas Coughlin has taken a major step towards alleviating some of the burden from the county jails. The Legislative Gazette's Brenda McMahon reports.
New York State Corrections Commissioner Thomas Coughlin has ordered 1,000 state-ready prison inmates who are currently in local prisons to be moved into state facilities immediately. For the past several months, local jails have been housing prison inmates who are required to be transferred to medium and maximum security prisons, but due to overcrowding, the inmates were kept in the county jails. Jim Flatteau, spokesman for the Corrections Commission.
There are inmates out in the counties who, by the nature of their crimes and length of their sentence, belong in maximum. They will go to maximum. The space is being created in medium security facilities and will house medium security inmates, either those in the system today in a max who will move to a medium, or people who are coming into the system who are qualified for medium placement. But people who are state ready out in the counties, who belong in a maximum security institution, will indeed go to a max.
Although there were three possibilities for housing the prisoners, two alternatives were rejected by the commissioner and the state's watchdog commission of corrections. The two ideas were doubling cells and tenting prisoners outside the facilities. The third alternative would consolidate dormitory bunks, putting them closer together and filling in the recreation areas. This was not the most popular plan, says William McMahon, chairman of the commission of correction, but it was a necessary step.
Well, there's no question that it's a very good idea, because we're trying to balance the whole system. The reason I did not come out with a complete endorsement was because I have not seen the locations, or staff has not been able to evaluate the facilities that they're going to be using, and I just was reluctant to make an endorsement until we had an opportunity to appraise them.
A future alternative for housing prisoners is the much-discussed prison barge. Flatow says New York entered into the competitive bidding process, but the award has not yet been announced. McMahon says if New York gets the barge, which houses 700 prisoners, it could be used for prisoners making a transition into the community.
Well, Commissioner Coghlan has also been given the opportunity to become involved in earned eligibility and work release. The work release program for the Department of Corrections has been expanded from 1 year to parole board to qualified candidates being 2 years to the parole board. That'll give him a pool of candidates that he can move into the barge that will be transitioning out of the system so that he'll be able to use work release people for that barge.
Commissioner Coghlan's original order to move 1,000 inmates came after the number of state-ready prisoners in local jails reached over 2,000 for the first time ever. The state facilities are already 9.4% above capacity, and Coghlan's move will put the prison to 12 to 13% above capacity. Even though these statistics are shocking, McMahon says Coghlan is doing a good job and the state's prison overcrowding issue could be alleviated in as few as 6 weeks. He says this is also a result of Governor Cuomo's efforts over the years.
Governor Cuomo took the initiative when he first came into office. The voters voted down a prison bond issue, and then he used some very good things to build 10,200 beds from 1983 until the present time. This present legislative session, he proposed another 4,800 beds that he's building in addition to 1,400 that they're building for the city of New York, so that the state administration has been addressing the overall prison problem with a massive building program. Governor Cuomo is building tremendous amounts of bed space, and now we have to get the locals to do the very same thing. I think that we will be able to handle our populations at the state level very adequately within the next 6 weeks, and if we can encourage the locals to continue to look at alternate sites and do building as needed, then we'll be able to handle the local system as well.
The 1,000 prisoners are expected to be moved into the state prisons by the end of the week. This is Brenda McMahon reporting.
Clarence D. Rapelier, the minority leader of the New York State Assembly, do the Republicans have a way of preventing corruption in our construction industry?
But not really preventing it totally. I'm sure that there's always, as we've gone through this period of ethical reform, I've said on many occasions, if somebody's inclined to be a crook, they're probably going to be one no matter what we write. But I think some of the recommendations we've made over the past couple of legislative sessions, especially in the area of public contracts, would help minimize that.
Okay, let's take it very simply and put it this way. I am a guy who is corrupt, and I'm entitled to award contracts in my hometown for constructing highways. A guy comes to me and offers me a kickback, and I take it. How would you stop that?
The rules and standards we've got right now governing public procurement are so diverse and so haphazard that they invite corruption, and conscientious public officials simply don't have the tools to police the bidding process and fight abuses. So first and foremost, we've got to establish some uniform statewide standards for public contracts. That I don't think that's so difficult. But right now, it's so diverse, it's such a patchwork, it lends itself to it and to corruption. And corruption gravitates to public works projects, as I say, for the same reason Willie Sutton robbed banks, because that's where the money is, and that's why we keep hearing about it.
Okay, now specifically, how do you do that?
Well, as I say, establishing uniform statewide standards is one thing. There are items also that we've got a recommendation that would permit the disqualification of potential bidders. Mm-hmm. We've got people in the process now that have a bad record for technical performance, and we've even got some bidding that have been convicted of felonies. So these would be grounds for disqualification.
Now, but that would address the contractors. But how about the corrupt public officials? And after all, remember the FBI said that they knew who these guys were because they had a reputation of corruption.
Well, no question about that. But I'd have to think that some of these people have gotten themselves into trouble. Most public officials who are in this have gotten themselves into trouble because of the structure of the system. And I think that you, by the same token, you know, as they're going to do in this case, I'm sure they're going to have to be tough on the penalty side. But up to now, a lot of these practices are practices that that have gone on because of the haphazard structure.
Does it scare you, Rapp, that, and you may be well be right about this, but does it scare you that the fact that they went to every one of these people and every single one of these people took the money that was offered except for one guy who said it wasn't enough?
I'm sure it frightens everybody.
Because it indicates that it's a lot more, it's, I mean, what if they had offered that money to everybody who was in the construction business?
Since the beginning of the New York City corruption scandals, it's been clear to me that we should be working on contract reforms because this is the fertile area. And far too little attention has been to this area of reform in the current wave of ethics laws that we've had, yet it's obviously an area that needs a whole lot of work. And I think contract reform is a priority. I think that both for the municipal officials who may be indulging in something that probably has been commonplace over the years, because of the system in place and because of people working with them who know that structure very well and know how haphazard it is, that if we do the reform in the contracts area, I think it'll work both sides, not just the contractors working with public officials, but the officials themselves.
And it'll take the temptation out of the whole thing.
Exactly.
Do you see that there'll be some people who will object to what you're suggesting? And I mean, you've been in the legislative process a long time. You can tell me right now, I'm sure, Rapp, if you have a mind to, who is going to be objecting to this schedule of reforms that you have?
I'm not so sure anyone will. I think it's sort of like young people. They kind of like to know guidelines. We all went through that period of time when the Dewey philosophy was approached, and, you know, everybody could do whatever they wanted, throw bricks through windows. It was a form of self-expression, but that's not true. I think young people want to know where the lines are, and I think people in government and in the contracting world might very well welcome this because I'm not so much convinced that it's intentional as it is it's accepted practice. So I think that really what we need right now is, and I think the irony of this whole thing is that the public works procurement system is so overregulated that it's undermanaged, and I don't think we got a total panacea. We never do, but I just think some of these recommendations, which are rather simplistic on their face, would help to bring some order out of chaos, making it more difficult or less likely for people on either side of the fence to get themselves in this bind.
Okay, last question, Rapp, and that has to do with your fellow Republican, Rudolph Giuliani, the prosecuting attorney in New York City. Now, he says New York State seems to be more inviting to corruption than other places in the country. Do you think he's right?
Well, certainly based on the papers we've been reading over the past few weeks, it started in the city of New York, and with some things that I don't think have even begun to analyze or gotten into the depth of, but beyond that now, this sting operation that goes statewide, it certainly would appear that we've got a whole lot bigger problem than anyone anticipated. As to how that squares with other states, I'm not really in a position to say, but I'd have to think that a whole lot of things in this society of ours right now are mandating that we go back and rework the rules and the procedures and everything else because they are inviting it. I'd have to think that maybe because we're one of the biggest and one of the most complex, that we're more fertile. But I've got to think that it perhaps goes everywhere in this country.
Clarence Rapelier is the Republican minority leader in the New York State Assembly. The resignation of former State University Chancellor Clifton Wharton, who left his position to accept a job with TIAA CREF, a retirement system for a reported $500,000 a year plus perks, has spurred debates about the low salary of that position. Filling the chancellor's post became a difficult challenge, and 6 months later it is still vacant. Many people believe this is because the salary of the university's leader did not reflect the compensation needed to attract a first-rate manager. This week, the Board of Trustees reversed that notion by raising the chancellor's salary, as well as many others in the SUNY system. The Legislative Gazette's Brenda McMahon has more.
The Board of Trustees of the State University of New York approved a salary plan this week which would increase the salaries of 32 senior positions in the state university system. The plan was proposed after the legislature passed a bill which formally gave the Board of Trustees the power to set salary levels for its top officials. Among the salary increases proposed was that of the chancellor post, which was vacated by Dr. Clifton Wharton this past February. Since Dr. Wharton resigned, filling the post has become increasingly difficult, and many have said it's due to the low salary. Jerome Commissar, acting chancellor and executive vice chancellor, says the approved salary will be higher than the current $93,000, but a limit has not yet been set. The plan approval by the Board of Trustees did, however, specify the chancellor's salary should be, quote, higher than any other administrative position in the university system. The highest SUNY salary is currently $135,000. Hugh Toohey, spokesman at SUNY Central, says the plan's approval will open up the interview process, which was stymied by the insufficient salary. Commissar agrees, but adds that the position would not be filled for salary alone.
Oh, it certainly will help. No one accepts a position like the chancellorship for salary alone. But the salary that was being paid to the chancellor was really considerably below market and far below what is paid to people in comparable positions. So it really was necessary to have a change.
Several other SUNY officials will be receiving raises ranging from $80,000 to $135,000 a year. The 29 presidents of the state campuses and the 4 SUNY university presidents will be included in the raise. Several of these individuals, as well as Dr. Commissar, will be receiving raises above Governor Cuomo's $100,000 salary. We asked organizational behavior expert David Crackard of Cornell University School of Business if this was an unusual phenomenon for appointed official salaries to surpass the governor's salary. But Crackard says the market economy and demand in the profession are in part responsible for the increase.
I mean, the reason they make more is because the market demands that. That is, they can quit, go off and get a job elsewhere, and make a lot more money. And so there are two senses of equity. There's the equity, there's a sense of equity within the firm, and that's one that creates problems when you have management that makes less than subordinates. But you also have the sense of the equity that when you compare your own salary to that of other firms and people who do the same kind of work in other places around the country or wherever. And that's the one that usually wins, because that's the one that the person can leave and go and get another job, and that's what determines the market price. So it does create problems, but it's not, it isn't unheard of. And the issue is, how do you manage the perceptions so that the sense of inequity does not dominate, so that people feel like they're being treated fairly?
Professor David Crackart. But the high salary is not an issue for Governor Cuomo, who publicly supported competitive salaries for educators after the board's approval. Cuomo said competitive salaries are important, even if those salaries exceed the salary of the state's top elected officials. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Brenda McMahon.
Fred Dicker of the New York Post recently returned from Nicaragua. How good it is to have you back, Fred.
Alan, I'm glad to be back. I mean, it was interesting down there, but there's no place like home.
Fred, let me start up in saying, have they ever heard of Mario Cuomo down in Nicaragua?
Well, a few people, I think, have. I was wearing a Cuomo T-shirt a couple of days, and I it's warm down there, so I changed the shirt. I had two of them. And a few people, mainly foreigners, ironically enough, in a way, including the PLO's ambassador to Nicaragua, the Sandinistas have diplomatic relations with the PLO, asked me about Cuomo. They're mainly curious. They don't know much about him, but they take him seriously. And the Nicaraguan people, though, they don't know who he is. They have their own problems to worry about.
Even though he's a baseball player and they're baseball nuts.
They are baseball nuts, but I don't think they remember the days of Glendy LeDuc.
Fred, right now, clue us in. Right now, Mario Cuomo sneezes. He announces he's going to start running again, and it gets on what we call the A-wire of the Associated Press, and we hear it on our morning news show, national news show.
No he's question. Alan Sharpluck made national news again. That was your break that revealed that story, as I recall. Am I right?
You're right. Okay. He goes to the Soviet Union and Poland in a little while. I know you're going with him. The question is, what is up? It seems to me, on the one hand, we have this announcement that he is not running, and he keeps telling us all he's not running, and personally and privately, he dismissed all of those people that would have been helping him on that kind of a campaign, and yet there is this, he's acting like a candidate.
No question, Alan. Look, it's almost September. I mean, the fall is going to be here, and with the fall arriving, we're almost to the New Hampshire primary. Things are going to start speeding up very quickly. What I think we have to do is keep our eye on the ball, eye on the mark, and not listen so much to what the governor is saying. Right now, Mario Cuomo is probably the hottest Democratic prospect in the United States. Right now, there's an overwhelming consensus in Democratic circles that none of the seven dwarfs, including the recently entered Snow White from Colorado, is really presidential timber. At least the feeling now is that none of these people are going to wind up being the candidate. And there's no doubt that some of the people around the governor, and I dare say the governor himself, are well aware of this, and they're keeping their options open, hence the jogging, hence getting into fighting trim. And I think we'll probably start hearing an increasing number of statements from the governor that he's not interested in the presidency, which I will take to mean that he probably is.
Now, play it out with us. As you and I meet people in the street, they always say, now, how would it look if he actually did get into it? He would have to go into some primaries, I would assume, because the concept of a brokered convention is almost impossible.
Well, unless it's deadlocked. I mean, it's not impossible. If it's deadlocked, and if, in fact, you have no clear consensus candidate who emerges as the choice of the Democrats, then a deadlock is possible. But let me just quickly mention this possible scenario. Comes late February, you have the Iowa caucuses. You have record low participation. It's clear the voters don't care and no clear emerging victor. The next week you go to New Hampshire. Once again, all of a sudden, record low Democratic turnouts, no clear winner. What happens in a few days is then you have Time Magazine and Newsweek having on its cover none of the above as the winner of the two first Democratic events. When that happens, if it happens, all of a sudden all bets are off. And it's very possible that there could be a groundswell of interest in Mario Cuomo, who in many Democratic circles nationally is a very popular and certainly well-regarded figure. And that's when we could start seeing the governor reconsidering.
Fred Dicker of the New York Post. And that's it for this week's Legislative Gazette. Our show is edited and produced by Brenda McMahon in the studios of WAMC Albany. She had help this week from Dave Galletly and Dan Analek. If you have any comments about our program, write us at Box 13,000, I say 1,000, Albany, New York, 12212. We'll be back again next week, and we hope you'll join us then. For now, I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University College at New Paltz.
Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.